name's Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document.
Our next guest was born in the East End of London in the 1920s. We speak about the Blitz, evacuation, unrecognised service, and breaking down taboos. We also speak about the vulnerability of children in conflict and how the Second World War still impacts him to this day. Episode 41, Stanley Moore. This is Declassified. When's your next birthday?
26th of February.
How old will you be then?
93.
93?
Yeah.
1927? Is that when you were born?
Born in 1927.
What's your first memory? Can you remember? Can you remember your first memory?
I can remember going down to my nan's house. We lived in Wilberforce Street, Canning Town. And my mum had no food, but she seen her mum, who lived in Hearn Street. And she said to me, she said, "Stanley, go down and see Nanny." So I go, come out of our house, do a left and a right, that's where Nanny lived. And when I get down there, I'd knock on the door, and but she had a chair outside already. She knew I was coming, and she would put dinner on the chair, and I was standing there eating it. And when I finished it, she said, "Now you go home to your mum."
How old was you then?
I must have been 3. And another early recollection was my old man was a street hawker, and he had a pony and trap. Well, it might have been a donkey and trap. And we were sitting outside my house in Canning Town on a summer evening, and he would start talking about different things, and he looked up and he said, "See all them stars up there?" He said, I said, "Yeah." I said, "We'll be flying up there before long, you know." He said, "Never, it never happened." But it did, didn't it?
It did happen, yeah.
Yeah.
It did. Did you have money growing up?
No.
No.
No, he had to go out collecting old iron.
Yeah.
Old rags, anything to get a few bob.
Yeah.
And you just go around singing old iron and lumber. If people had any stuff to get rid of, they would give them a penny or 8p to get rid of it.
Would then he sell it on?
Oh, yeah. He would get enough for his beer and enough for mum to get a dinner or something like that. But he was gassed in the First World War, and he was an invalid. He couldn't do much. He couldn't really do much about it. That's the only thing he could do, scrap iron merchant.
How did it affect him, the gassing of the First World War?
Couldn't breathe properly.
Really?
Couldn't breathe properly. And I remember when Dad was taken ill, and my mum said, "You better go and see Dad." All my brother was there, and my sister. And my sister wasn't there then. And we went in to see him, and he was propped up in bed, and his hands was like this. He couldn't move. You know, he just about talked, he could. The doctor said, "He's not going to make it."
Mm.
So it must have been 1934, 33.
Right.
And 34, no, it must have been earlier than that, because the doctor said, He's not gonna last the weekend. So my mum's sister, who was living in a room as well in this house, she said, "Let's take him round to Pitshead pub and give him some drink. Got any money?" She said, "I ain't got no money, but I know where the old man keeps his..." He had a golden guinea. He kept behind the overmantel for his anything good comes up. When he was out collecting, he would buy it and sell it on. And so he took the guinea, or she took the guinea, and they dressed him, took him out of Pitshead, and they bought him double rum, double whiskey, and they had a good drink as well. Guinea could buy a lot them days. And they got him a little bit on the piss side. He walked back by himself, and as he was walking back, he had a lot of stairs, something like these, to walk up to our room. And when he got in, our room, he said to his mum, Eva, my mum, who paid for all this beer then? And she said, well, you did. She said, oh, I took your golden guinea. And he couldn't believe it. He said, what should we take that for? And he started throwing the chairs out the window.
God.
And of course, you can just imagine, in the still of the night or whatever, everybody was out looking what was happening. And somebody run round the police station, which was only round the corner. And the old coppers come with their truncheons, come upstairs, and they started hitting him with the truncheons.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, try and calm him down. And, of course, my mum, had to protect him. She said, leave him alone, he's all right. But they carted him off in the Blackmore to the police station. He had to go before Stratford Assizes the next morning. And my mum's never been to court, so she went with Aunt Dole, and she started listening to all the various cases that was on. And all of a sudden, the usher said, Benjamin Moore. The old man come out, stood in the dock and said, you are accused of being drunk and disorderly. How do you plead? Guilty, my lord. I fine you 5 shillings or 7 days. Bump. So they called him off, and Mum and Dole were still sitting there listening to all the cases, and all of a sudden Aunt Dole said, here, hope you've got enough money to pay Dad's, pay Ben's fine. So she had to go home, get the 5 shillings, and come back and bail him out. And he lived 7 years after that. That is amazing, isn't it?
The policeman knocked some health back into him.
Most probably. And, cool. But anyway, I remember going to his funeral. Let me see.
How old was you then? How old was you when your dad died?
I was 6, 4. 7.
Was you?
Something like that. And something like that, because 3 years later, the war broke out. So, round about it.
Was the, just at that time, just before the war, what was the kind of community like around Canning Town? Was it inclusive? Did everyone kind of help each other?
Everybody knew everybody else. Everybody could leave their doors open. And most families had a key like that on the inside of the door. So you could come up, open the letterbox, put your finger in and pull the key out and open the door. Most people had that. And it was a nice community. Everybody knew everybody else. But money was very difficult to come by. How I didn't take this up when I was younger, I didn't have the sense. But what I would do, I would go down to the allotments and I would say to the bloke who's on the allotment, can you give me a halfpenny worth of mint? And he would pick me a big bunch of mint and I would take it down to Rathbone Street and I would sell it to the people and I'd make 2 shillings. I'd make 2 shillings from that halfpenny bunch of mint. And I would go to the pitches. I can go to the pitches with that sort of money. But I only done it when I needed the money. I didn't think of saying, oh, blimey, I'd do that next time.
Was that because you didn't need anything? Because when you say about, the doors being left open, because there was nothing to steal, I suppose, was it that way of living? You're just kind of surviving?
Well, that's how they used to be. But there was a Woolworths near us, and I was a little urchin. There's no two ways about it. I would nick sweets. I would go in there and nick sweets and things like that. But when the old man died, I was I used to go down to the marketplace and pick all the specked apples, bananas, anything I could nick, I'd take it, you know. But I would get mostly all the specked ones, and she would cut all the bad bits out, and we'd have a meal, you know.
When your dad died, did you really feel the impact of it?
Yeah,
financially?
Because my mum never got no welfare. There was no welfare them days. And, of course, it was me two brothers working. That was a big help until they got called up in 1939. And, boom, mum had nothing. And it was worse still then for a while until she started getting the money through from the army. But she kept the family together by... She would look after gentlemen's, do their cleaning, do their cooking. And when she met a gentleman in the pub, she said, well, I'll come round and clean your house and things like that. And I'll get your dinner ready for when you come home. And she used to do that. But when she had the dinner, she used to bring the kids in to have a dinner as well. So she would do enough for all the kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And one house we got bombed out of in Tidal Basin. For the life of me, I don't know what street it was. It was one of these houses we was in, and it got bombed. So we had to go to another house. But she kept the family afloat, and got really bad with the war. There was peppering the docks, and there was getting all bombs dropping all over the place.
Do you remember when the war broke out?
Yeah.
What was the feeling like? What did your mum?
Well, the feeling was when I first heard it, I was out in the street in Peter Street, and I shouted out "Yippee!" You know, I was only 13. You know, and of course I went running in and said, "Mum, we got a war. We're going to war again." Poor mum burst out crying. She said, I didn't want that. Of course, she lost her two sons. And so she had to fend for herself.
Did the boys then go... Oh, sorry, did your brothers, your older brothers, did they go straight away?
They went practically straight away.
Yeah.
And that was in the army when we had Dunkirk. But this Teddy Eaney, who lived upstairs in our house, he bought that lifeboat, and he converted it to a cabin cruiser.
So this was before, this was 1935, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he bought. What did he? Where did he buy the lifeboat from?
He bought the boat from a liner that was broken at Southend. I'm sure it was broken at Southend. It might have been the Lusitania, or one like that. And he bought this 40-foot lifeboat. And he rowed it back to the London docks. My two brothers went with him. Might have been about 1936, 1937. And, well, in our back garden, I know there was engines, lorry engines and car engines, wrapped up, because he was an engineer. And so he must have used one of them to put in his boat. Because he had a mask on it as well, and he made a wonderful job of it. I used to go down and help him, and every spare minute I had, it was only walking distance where I was, and I overheard him talking to an officer in the Navy, might have been a petty officer, I don't know, and he said, we're going to confiscate the boats, we want people to take them to Dunkirk.
Yeah.
To help to...
Evacuate
the troops. He said, yeah. He said, I'm for it. And he said, I think we're going first thing in the morning. And so he said, be prepared, fill up with petrol, etc. And you can get reimbursed for all your petrol and things like that. So I thought, blimey, I think I'll go. I went home with him, and I came back later on, by myself, and I hid. And I was hoping I was going to go in next morning, but it never got. They got postponed that morning.
Ah.
It was the next day. But my mum found out that I was missing, and she's going frantic trying to find me. And Teddy Eaney came along and said, I'm looking for Stan. And she said, I bet I know where he is. And he went down to the boat and I was here. So I got told off when I got indoors. But I missed him. So they went to Dunkirk without me.
Mm. Was your brothers, did they get evacuated from Dunkirk?
No, they wasn't. They weren't at Dunkirk. But ah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see your brothers throughout the war? Did they ever come back?
Yes, I'll see them both. My brother Bill was in the Duke Cornwall's Light Infantry, and he went with General Montgomery, wiped through the African campaign. Mm. And then they was very successful. And my brother got picked out, must have been 1944. He got picked out because Dunkirk, he had an ear, lip and cleft palate. So people would feel sorry for him. And his old sergeant major would say to him, Moore, go on, get your gear together. You've got a job. So he would pack his big bags and he would go. He didn't ask no questions. He just done it.
Mm.
And he said, you're escorting some prisoners back to England.
Mm.
And my mother was cock-a-hoop because she said, Brother Bill's coming home. And look out for him. I lived in Malmesbury Road at that time, and it was a massive, great, big, long road. And we was all taking turns going out there looking for him to come down the road. And then my little brother come in and said, there's a black man coming down there. Which my mum said, well, it's not him, is it? And it was him. He was absolutely burnt. Burnt black he was.
Yeah.
And he came in. He came in, oh, dear, what joy. And we went up to the Liverpool Arms. All he had was his KD on. He had his KD and nothing else. And we went into the Liverpool Arms and everybody was buying him pints. He got real pissed, he did. And lovely, really lovely. Anyway, he had his 7 days leave and he went back to his regiment and he went to Italy. And he was at a casino when they were trying to take it, and he lost nearly all his mates there.
Did he?
They was in a very strong position, the old Germans. They dug right in and they had the whip hand. Then the sergeant major came up and said, all right, lads, get your gear together. We're being rested. And the old Americans come to take over. And so my brother came back with his company. And when they got, long way from the casino, the old sergeant major said, all right, lads, we'll sit down and have a smoke. And, of course, I was pleased as punch, I was out of it. And I was sitting down having a smoke when a stray mortar come over, landed right close to them. And a lump of shrapnel went through my brother's leg, started at the top and come out here.
Yeah.
And it severed his nerve, and his leg was like that. He had a spring. He had a spring till the day he died on his shoe.
To keep his foot from coming back up, or to allow his foot to come
spring,
up?
The spring would lift it back up.
Wow.
Because he couldn't do it. And he got a pension for that, but clasped round here.
Oh, Stan, just come back, mate.
And it clasped round his leg, and with a spring on it, so that every time he walked...
Yeah, it came back up.
It would come up automatic.
Do you remember the first time you were bombed?
Pardon?
Do you remember the first time you was bombed when you was in Canning Town?
Yeah.
What was it like, the Blitz?
Oh, the Blitz was terrible, really terrible. We at first we didn't have a shelter. We would go into church halls or the town hall, county town, and but all they'd done was down the basement they would put reinforced 6x4s right in there, loads and loads of them. But if there was a direct hit, wouldn't stand a chance, would it?
Mm.
But anyway, we went to the local church in Mary Street. Then we started going to different houses where Mum was doing her good deed for the day. And I think she'd done that all her life, really, until when the old man died. Because two of my brothers and a sister, only half brothers.
Mm.
So, in actual fact, she was having it away with these men, and sometimes she would fall pregnant.
Mm.
And, of course, I love them just as much, whether they're half brothers or full brothers, you know. This was our life. And we got bombed in the house, and we was told we had to evacuate. And that's when we evacuated to, went onto a farm first, and we was in a barn, sleeping on hay or straw. I tell you what, life comfortable. Well, I tell you, it's, you never get nothing more comfortable than that. And but the rats was running all over us every night, and the old farmer's wife would bring in a bucket of milk for us in the morning. And but it was a training ground for land army girls. And of course, I was getting a little bit bigger then. I was 14, and there was a wire mesh going between us, you know. But the girls, land army girls, saying, "Come and stand it," when they found out my name, "come and stand it, come over here. We'll teach you all about farming." Yeah, but I was so naive.
Yeah.
I didn't know nothing. And then we went from there to South Wales, or to Annisonville.
Before we get to Wales, so did within that time, so within the start of the Blitz, so you'd been bombed out of your, how many houses had you been bombed out of?
No,
at this
we,
point?
We blasted out of one house.
Yeah.
And but we were in the shelter, and a bomb went off close and blasted all the windows, and that's the first thing that goes, you know, like in a blast.
Yeah.
And
at South Hallsville, can you give us a bit of backstory of what actually happened there, Hallsville?
Well, actually,
I don't know anything about it.
What it was a school, Hallsville School. It was in Tidal Basin, right near Rathbone Street. And the authorities said, what we do, we'll all the people that gets bombed out, we'll put them into the school with their children. And when we got enough, we'll get some coaches and evacuate them out to the country. But there was getting so many people bombed that it was getting more and more and more. And eventually they said that they sent coaches and lawyers down to pick them up. But instead of going to Canning Town, they went to Camden Town.
Hmm.
And in that time, they was getting their way back to Canning Town, a bomber dropped right on the school. And it flattened it. And just the girders, I think, sticking up. And, of course, straight away, the crew went in to get out the bodies, anybody alive. They worked very hard, them people. Oh, dear.
To get to help get the bodies out?
Yes.
The rescue?
You know, if there was anybody alive. And that, I see dozens, really dozens and dozens of bodies being pulled out. They had a barrier around the school, but I could see what was happening. And they made the announcement saying that 70 people got killed in that school. But I said, nah, it was more than that. I see more than that.
Wait, what was it actually like then around the... Because this was this a disaster? I'm assuming this was like a...
That was a disaster.
Yeah.
Absolute disaster.
Because fundamentally, these people in that school were East End refugees, really.
They was, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they was. They was.
There were people ready to go out, women, children, is that right?
Absolutely, all the lot. Yeah.
And they were waiting in the school.
I was waiting in the school.
To get evacuated out.
Yeah, waiting for the lorries and the buses to come up, take them away.
And a bomb dropped on them?
And a bomb dropped on the school while it was all in it.
Was the families together then?
Yep.
All from the same area? From around Canning Town?
All from the same area. Silvertown, Canning Town, Tidal Basin, Custom House. Because bombs was dropping fast and furious all over the place.
How long was you in the Blitz for then? How many... Was it days or weeks or months before you got
evacuated?
Oh,
it was months.
Just constant bombing almost nightly?
Every night.
Was it?
Yeah, every night.
What was your mum like at this point? Was she a nervous wreck or was she strong?
No, she was a darling. She had a sit in the... When we got our Anderson shelter, they finally put an Anderson shelter in our house. And we used to go in the Anderson shelter and... She used to have a singing, and I think that's why I'm still like it now. And try and keep out the noise of the bombs.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, when we finally got evacuated, we got evacuated down to that farm in Oswestry Street, I think it was. It was lovely because... There was no bombing or nothing like that. But when we went hot picking, we had trenches round the field where we was picking hops. And if the planes come over low, you knew they was going to machine gun us.
The Luftwaffe?
Luftwaffe. So we would get in a trench.
So on the way back out from London...
Coming out of the way from London or something like that.
Yeah, and then you'd be in the fields picking hops. And they'd just shoot you. They'd just try and machine gun you.
Yeah, it was machine gunning, yeah. Not everyone done it, but everyone, now and again there was one that done it. If he see somebody moving, he would shoot them.
Bloody hell. When did you go to Wales then? Why did you leave the farm?
Well, we finished hop picking, or finished potato picking. Potato picking, that's right. We was potato picking, and we left the farm and we went to South Wales.
Did the full family go?
The old family, yeah. Dog as well. We had a dog as well named Peggy, and we were separated at first in Wales. Me and my young brother Reg went with another collier, another man. Didn't actually like him. He was very strict. He said, "We're having our dinner at 5 o'clock. And if you're not here by 5 o'clock, he said, you don't get nothing to eat. He said, so you go out and play. And so we went out to play on the fields and not fields, the hills. Oh, it was lovely.
What's it?
All the fern. Yeah, it was really lovely, it was. And I said, look, my brother said, how do we know it's 5 o'clock? And he's got, oh God, I can see it now. He had a big pocket watch hanging on his overmantle. I said, I'll take this. So I took his watch and we went off to play. And he come in and see his watchman sitting. See his watchman sitting and he told the coppers. And anyway, we come back at 5 o'clock. He said, I don't want him here no more. Take him out. So Mrs. Davis, who took the other three kids, or four kids, what Mum had, she said, bring him over here. So I went over with them. Never even got a meal there. You know, he was really, really upset about that.
I'm not surprised.
I only borrowed it.
Yeah. You was problem solving.
Yeah.
You were problem solving. Yeah. When you got back with your mum and the family were together, was you welcomed into the community within Wales?
Oh, yeah. The Welsh people were darlings, absolutely darlings. And I've always had a soft spot for them. That was very kind and considerate. My mum would go down the local pub, which was taboo for a lady to go in a pub. And she met this widower, George Bainham, who lived opposite us in Thompson Villa. I think it was Thompson Villa. And they were both widows, you know, so they liked each other's company. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, I started working down a coal mine. And
can you tell me this? Can we talk about why you ended up working? So you did, and why you didn't go to school?
We were sent to Annesley Bull in Wales. And my mum said, it must have been in February, because my mum said, you're 14 now, Stanley, you can go and get a job. So I started trying to find a job in South Wales, in this little village. And nobody would give me a job, nothing. And they said, you're not 14. I said, oh, I'm 14. They said, you've got to get a legal certificate. I look so young. It's like now, people don't believe that I'm 92.
No, I mean, you really don't look 92.
Yeah, I've still got black beard, you know. It's incredible. I ain't got nothing on top, but it's amazing. And but anyway, so I went back to school, and the man who was in charge of school leavers, he said, what do you want to do with your life, Stanley? And I didn't have a clue. Didn't know nothing about anything, because I was always playing truant from school, going on the Woolwich Ferry. I loved that. Really loved it. And but I would get four. I'd get four of a kind from the headmaster, Mr. Wicklock. So when I played truant, I'd come in the next day and I would sit outside the headmaster's office for his two in each hand. But it was worth it. I don't think I'm an alter at all. And
did you leave school then? Is that when you left school? Did you get your
I've got
chit?
My leaver certificate. I've got my leaver certificate. And he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I don't know. I said, I want to help my two brothers. And he said, the only way you can help your two brothers, he said, is go and get a job down a coal mine. He said, get good money. 30 shillings a week, I think it was. Good God. And I'd go for all that for 30 shillings. Anyway, so I had my first day. The only thing that I was disappointed with the coal mine is that everybody got electric light, a battery-operated light, but they would always give me an oil-operated one. There must have been a reason for it. You know, and
because you start at the bottom and work your way up to the electric light.
Well, at least it wasn't a candle. But anyway, I did enjoy it down the coal mine. It was they had these horses down there, ponies.
What, down in the mine?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, the ponies. Oh, and I loved them. I loved any animals, and I was first put with a collier, who was preparing for the automation conveyor belt to go through.
Okay.
So we had a seam of coal, and we had to make enough room for the conveyor belt to go through. And so he would dig, and I would dig as well, and he would put it on this little truck. They call them drams, but they're a little truck, and fill it up. And then the altar come down, or the punter come down. They'd hook him up, take him up, and hook it on to all the others, going all the coal going out. But when we got this conveyor belt in, then they would send in about 10 or 8 colliers, all young fellas with their shovel and their pick, and they would start. No, they would have a cutter, automatic cutter go through, cutting all the coal.
Mm.
And they would start shoving it onto the conveyor belt. And when I started doing that, I had a different job then. I'd go down to the end of the conveyor belt, where the belt turns round, and this is something I'll never forget. He said to me, he said, "This is your job standing now. See that piece of wood on the bottom belt?" He said that all the dust and all the bits of coal comes off, because if you let that go, it builds up and builds up, and the conveyor belt will break. He said, and if the conveyor belt breaks, he said, they'll take all your money off you to repair it. And I thought, oh, God, blimey. But it was all right, you know. Every now and again, I would get a shovel and shovel the coal and coal dust. But as the collier, as the miners got further away from the conveyor belt, they would have to throw it, and lots of it was going on the bottom belt. And it would come round, and I was crying because I couldn't shovel fast enough to keep it away.
Was it hard work?
Oh, was it? Was it?
I just picture it. If I picture working down a coal mine...
Yeah, a little boy 40.
Yeah, a little
and
boy.
I had that job, and I was kneeling on my knees, and I keep shoveling it, because the conveyor belt was going round all the time.
Were you getting stronger physically as well?
Oh, yeah. I've been as strong as a lion I've all my life.
Yeah.
No two ways about it. And the dust, couldn't see for dust, it's like a fog it was. But I got over that, and then when that seam had finished, they would have to shift the conveyor belt to another seam. And I would go with the collier, and we would do the same thing. He would start hacking out enough for the conveyor belt to go in. And one day, there was a big slope, really, really big slope it was, where we had to go down to get the seam. And they had one of the bigger horses, and he was one of the shire horses, little shire horses. They're much bigger than a pony. Mm. And he would hook the truck of coal on, and he would struggle up the hill to the top. And but when he got to the top, the bloke at the top shouted out, "Below!" And the dram of coal had broken away before they could put it on the straight. So it started coming down at a real rate of knots. One of the fire, I didn't know what was going on, but one of the firemen, he was one of the foremen. Mm. He dived over and got me out of the way of the dram, or the truck that was coming down, and it slammed into the coal face.
Bloody hell.
And so he saved my life, really.
Yeah. Did you feel like the work you was doing in the coal mine, was that fueling the war effort?
That was the war effort.
Yeah. And no, I know that. But what I'm saying is, did you feel like you were being part of it? Because obviously you wanted to go help your brothers.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Did
yeah.
you feel like every because time you was
the teacher said to me, he said, "You're going to help your brothers more than anything by doing this." And of course, then I was quite pleased and proud when I got my wages.
Yeah, yeah. Did you used to give your wages to your mum?
Yeah, I'd give my wages to my mum. She'd give me back my pocket money.
Did she?
And she would, every day, she would do me jam sandwiches to take down a coal mine. We had a little tin. And also a tin bottle, about the same size as that,
yeah,
with water in. And I had this little tin with half a dozen sandwiches, bread and jam sandwiches. And when we knocked off for tea or whatever, we would sit down eating our sandwiches, and I would give mine to the horse. And he loved it. He really loved it.
Was there people from all around the country that were down the mine, or was it mainly Welsh?
There was all sorts down the mine. There was Poles, Scottish people, mostly Welsh people down here.
Mm.
But these three blokes that done it on me, I'm not sure what they was.
Well, let's take us there then. So every day you used to come out of the mines, you used to get a shower. So there was individual shower cubicles. And then one day
these three blokes come in.
Go on, tell me about, if for you know, go into as much detail or as little detail as you want, what happened?
Well, you say, I take my clothes off, put them outside and went into my cubicle, and I started having my shower, just started, when these three blokes come into my cubicle, and they started pulling me about. I didn't know what I was doing, got no idea. And I didn't think that anything happened because I was such a slippery little thing, and I just soaked myself, and I run out. I managed to get out.
How long was they in there with you?
Oh, I don't know how long it was. But it wasn't until I got home that I realised that my mum got the bath and my backside was smarting, something horrible, and it was bleeding as well.
So you'd been raped?
My mum knew. She didn't mention anything about. I didn't know I'd been raped. Got no idea. I didn't know what. I was so naive. Didn't know nothing actually. And my mum said, "Go up and ask for your cards. You're not going down there no more." So I went up to the pit head, went into the office, and said. My mum said, "Can I have my cards?" And they said, "Sorry, but you can't have my cards from here. This is a very essential war job. All the ships rely on coal to go along." And I went back and told my mum. And she said, "Right," she said, "I'll go up and get your cards." So I went up, she went up. I didn't go up with her. And she come back and she said, They wouldn't give them to me, but I told them to poke them up there, Jaxie. And she said, "We're going back to London."
And was it because of the event? Was it because of being raped?
So we...
Is that why she'd made the decision?
She made a decision.
To move you away from the...
She didn't want none of her kids being raped.
Of course.
And so she went back to London.
Did you ever discuss it after?
No. But I had that feeling all the time. That feeling all the time.
What feeling?
Well, that something had happened and I didn't like it. And it wasn't until I got married and had three boys. It wasn't until then that as they started getting their own families, I decided to sell them.
Mm. Had you blocked it out of your memory?
Yeah, tried to block it out, but every now and again it'd come back.
Would it?
Yeah, and it's only recently that I can really talk about it.
Mm. It sounds very much like it had just become this foggy memory. Even when you're describing it then, you didn't really understand what had happened. It was confusing as a small boy.
I was hoping that I was going to completely forget about it, but you can't. You can't forget about it. Something keeps bringing it back all the time.
It highlights the fact that children, especially during the evacuation, were so vulnerable.
Yeah.
How could a 14-year-old go down the mine? Be like, It's just unheard of now in this country, you know.
But when you go back to history, they had little boys of 11 going down the coal mines.
Really?
Yep. 11. 10.
Yeah, but it was like unrecognised, wasn't it? The service that that you all did.
It wasn't recognised. Wouldn't recognise the service.
Yeah.
I know I've got a medal for the coal mine, but I think in a way that I was entitled to that medal.
I think you was.
And it's only a it's only a piece of bleeding tin anyway. You know. I'll get no pension or anything for it. I want it.
Do you look back at the time, that 9 month period, with pride, or was it tarnished by what happened at the end?
Well, I was pleased that I went down here because I wanted to help my two brothers. I was pleased about that. I was pleased about meeting the horses and the ponies.
When you came back to Canning Town, so your mum got you all together, all the kids, you got on the train, back in.
We come back to the bombing. She packed the next day or the day after that, as soon as she got the tickets to go back to London. And we got on the train. I think we had to get on the train. That might have been Cardiff. It might have been Cardiff. We got to go to the train. And you can just imagine it, all army personnel, navy personnel, all going on leave, all going to different places. You can just imagine it. I generally see a film of Waterloo journey during the war, and the amount of uniforms, everybody had a uniform on them days. And anyway, we came back. I wanted to help. I became a messenger boy for the civil defence, ARP.
Had it changed? Had Canning Town changed a lot from when you, in that short space of time of you going to Wales and then you coming back? Had it changed a lot? Had it been heavily bombed?
Heavily bombed, and all you could see is vacant places where houses was.
Where did you live? Where did you go back to?
We went back to Malmesbury Road, that backed onto the railway. And we had an Anson shelter there. My nan lived there, actually, but her daughters took her out of there and moved her down to St Albans just after we got there.
Did you stay in your nan's house? Is that where you stayed?
Well, we stayed in nan's house, but we had the upstairs flat. And nan had the downstairs flat. But when she went to St Albans, we had the whole house. So we had the whole house together. So we had,
was the Blitz still going on? Was you still getting bombed?
The Blitz was still going on.
Really?
Yeah. And anyway, I got a... I had several jobs I had making tyres, airplane tyres I was making, and I was Canning Town glass blowers. That job I had for a spell, and I was making jam jars, but my particular thing, making jam jars. It's amazing when I first see it, you know, seeing the molten glass being cut, going into a mould, and as it goes round to the next cycle, and compressed air come and blow it up to the size of the jam jar. And by the time it gets round to me, it was open, and my job was to take the jam jar, which was still red hot, and put it on a conveyor belt to go downstairs. They had to dry very gradual. During the summertime, we would go up onto the factory roof. They got a big water tank. We would go swimming, and but sometimes when during the flying bombs, You could see from a distance the flying bombs going across. You could see the exhaust. And see, when you're young, you ain't got a care in the world. And just imagine a bleak doodle bug coming over and you're in the swimming pool. And good God almighty.
A different time.
Yeah.
Did you just become, because I suppose you were just totally acclimatized to it all. That's how you'd been brought up from.
Yeah.
You know, being.
Yeah, it comes yeah. natural, yeah.
Just normal to see yeah. bombs flying in and people getting.
But this
particularly. Houses getting bombed.
This particular night I was on night work, I finished my shift and I heard that the Lambs and Paragon, which was a local paper factory, had got hit. And I had two mates lived round there. So I went to find out if it was if they was all right. So I walked down to Trinity Church and I got on the Beckton Road and I walked down the Beckton Road and it's a dog leg. You go down a bit and it's a sort of a left dog leg. And when I got down to the bottom to turn left, I could hear the breaking of wood. And I thought, what's that? And when I looked down at the bottom, I could see Beckton Road Park. And I see this flying bomb cutting all the tops of the trees off. And I thought, oh, God, it's coming straight towards me.
A doodle bug.
And I dropped to the floor, put my hands over my head, and it went off. And I don't know how lucky I was there, because when I woke up, when I looked up, I see all the bricks and rubble all down the road, and a bloke come along soon after, and he's picking up all the intestines. People have been blown to pieces.
Really?
That was walking to work. Walking down Beckton Road towards Trinity Church, and they was blown to pieces.
And you unhurt?
I was just round the corner a little bit, and that really protected me. And I went back later on after I had my sleep. I went back and I had a look, see where it was. And I couldn't tell you to this day what road it was, but...
Was you scared at that point?
Oh, yeah, I just froze. Oh, I wet myself.
Did you?
Yeah, I fell in the gutter and I wet myself. And I thought, this is it, I'm going to die. But it must have killed over. As it come down, it must have touched something with his wing and it went to the right.
And veered off. Was it coming right at you?
Right at me. Absolutely spot on. Oh, blimey.
And then you went home and had a sleep?
Eh?
Then you went home and had a sleep?
I went home.
Did you tell
and had
your mum and stuff? Did you say, oh, this has just happened?
Yeah. I went home and I slept.
Bloody hell.
Yes.
I mean, the East End got absolutely hammered as well. Like, it's not like it was in the middle of the countryside.
The East
if you look
End
at the
got
Blitz.
Absolutely popped with Sammy the Docks.
Yeah.
We was all down the docks, and the docks got absolutely palpated.
Do you remember the end of the war?
The end of the war? Yes, I remember the end of the war.
What was the feeling like?
Oh, the feeling was absolutely, absolutely wonderful. And everybody was so happy. But what I'm going to tell you now, you're never going to believe. My brother had his piano accordion. Wherever we went, we took his piano accordion with us. And people were saying, we're having a party in Liverpool Road. And somebody said, anybody got any musical instruments? Take them down for the party. So I took the piano accordion. I took Sid's piano accordion out, and I put it on, and I went walking down to Liverpool Street or Liverpool Road, and I said, "Oh look, is somebody here got a piano accordion?" And they shoved me right up the front, and they said, "Coming in," and I was, the only thing I could play was. But how did I do that? I don't know. But that's how happy they was.
Yeah.
Nobody didn't say nothing. But of course, then we finished up and I went back home, put Sid's accordion back.
So the end of the war came. Did both your brother, both your brothers were back? Did they all come back to Canning Town?
Well, yeah, well, Bill come back a little bit early. Now, I told you about that, didn't I? But he come back on leave during the war. And all he had was his KD uniform on, shorts.
And they got him drunk.
And we got him drunk, yeah.
But when after the war, and then how long did it take? So when, I suppose, victory was declared, how long was it before your brothers came back?
Oh, I can't tell you how long it was, but it wasn't all that long.
No.
Wasn't all that long, because we was all in the house together. And brother Bill got married, and he went off. And then brother Sid, when he come home after the war, he found out his wife was evacuated down to Saffron Walden. And he had a Dear John letter.
Oh.
While he was in the army, and some of his spoils from the war, he had a German Luger, and he had a German Leica, and they had him in his briefcase, you know. And when he got this Dear John letter, he just put all his stuff indoors, and he said, "I'm going to go down and see Maggie," and he took his Luger with him, and. He went all the way down. My mum's arguing with him. "Don't go, Sid. Don't go. Don't go." He said, "I've got to, Mum." He said, so he went down to Saffron Walden, and he met Maggie, his wife, and also an ex-sailor and with one leg. And when my brother saw his one leg, he thought, "Oh, well, how can I shoot him?" So he came back, don't know what happened to the Luger, and I don't know what happened to the Leica. And, but he got married then. He got married to a girl from Yardley's, funny enough.
You moved away, so you joined the Royal Artillery. You served in Palestine and Egypt.
Yeah.
That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Palestine and Egypt. Then when you came out, 2 years in, you came out. You moved down to Ilford, got married in 1950.
Yeah.
You want to move us to your wife and I suppose family life as well now. Did your childhood impact the way you brought your own children
up? Oh, yes. I'm very proud of my three sons. They're brought up just the way that I would like them to be. Kind, considerate and thought for others.
Mm. And you lost your wife... who I know you doted on in 2008. What was it like? I suppose you'd been with her for, what was it, 60 years? Is that right?
60 years, yeah. Yeah.
And losing her, what... Because after you lost her, you started speaking a lot about... Or you certainly started remembering a lot about what had happened in Wales with the coal mine. And why did you feel like you... Did you ever speak to her about it?
No. I never spoke to her about it at all. Not once. And and funny enough, all the letters that I wrote to her when I was a pen pal, and I had them all upstairs in the loft. But then she started going through a very traumatic patch before she died, and she finished up with Alzheimer's. And I could never find all them letters.
Oh, really?
I think it's 2 or 3 letters I think I've still got up in the loft now. But they're nice reading, you know. When I read them, they make me cry. And but that's how life is.
But what was your wife like?
Wonderful girl.
She?
Yeah, really wonderful. All the family was a wonderful, wonderful family. The Bell family. The old man used to play the piano. That's how I met Joan, because my brother played in the band with the old father-in-law. He played the piano and my brother played the piano accordion. And we got on and we fell in love and we got married. And we decided to buy a house. And, God, this is a laugh, this is. And we found a house near the mother-in-law in Percy Road, where I'm living now. And there was a house for sale, £1,300. And we had enough of the deposit. And we bought the house. And the repayments was £9 a month. But that was like a king's ransom. Because I was only working, I was working at the time, I was working at a rubber place in Barking. I was working piecework and I was working very hard. £17 a week I was getting. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, I got this letter to say that the National Dock Labour Board, if you want to start work Monday. But it was a week late because it went to my old address. And when I got the letter, I thought, well, I've lost it. But there was a phone number there, and I phoned them up and said, under the circumstances, you can start this Monday. And I said to my father-in-law, I said, what am I going to do, Dad? I said, shall I take a chance? He said, well, I said, I can't tell you what to do and what not to do. He said, but I can tell you this. If you get a job down the docks, he said, if you go down to the docks and see the ship and you see all the cars all parked around the ship that belong to the dockers, where they got the money from, buy them. He said, so go for it. So I never slept at all that night, making up my mind that I was going to chuck that £17 a week job up to go down the docks. So I did. I went down the docks and somebody told me that whatever you do, see an old docker and ask him, tell him your first day in the docks. And I said, this old docker, I said, look, I said, my first day here, Gov, I said, what do you reckon? Don't go on the ships. He said, go over there, he said, and do delivering. He said, that'll be better for you until you get used to it. So I went over there and I put my book in and I got my first job down the docks delivering flour, 208 bags of flour that'd been unloaded from the ship and it was going on lorries. I found it very difficult at first, but I managed the day out. I was getting quite good. And the ganger said to me, he said, right, he said, we're finished now. He said, do you want to know how much you earn? I said, yes, please. He said, we've earned £17 today. I said, you're joking.
Each?
He said, no.
You earned £17 in one day?
Yeah, £17 in one day. And I said, good God, I can't get home quick enough to tell my wife. Yeah. And so I went, this will kill you, this will. I went home. I said to my wife, I said, here, my first day, I said, how much do you think I've earned? She said, no, how much? I said, £17. Good God, she said, blimey, we can get new curtains. We can do that.
Typical.
And anyway, I went there the next day, and it was £19 we earned. And I thought, oh, blimey, what a job. And then on the third day, well, I went down there to pick a job up and there was a strike. Oh, and that's how it was.
Yeah.
I loved
the good
it.
Times and the bad times, roll with it. How long was you there for? On the docks?
I was there for about 18 years.
Was you?
I loved every bit about it, everything about it.
Yeah. The can I just take us to after your wife died? Because I really want to hit on a few things, really. And why was it important for you to start speaking and acknowledging what had happened in Wales? Why do you think it was so important? Why are we sat here?
I don't know. I've got no idea why I'd done that. I felt that I should know back from them. They're my children, you know. They might have the same thing happen to their children, you know. And that's when I decided to tell them.
Do you think it's important for parents to be able to speak to their kids?
Oh, yes.
And have open dialogue?
Yeah. I know when I was brought up, we didn't have sex lessons. You know, little boys, you would automatically go and try and look in the girls' toilets, things like that, you know, and the girls would look in the boys' toilets. That's it. That's intermingling. They find out all right. But
what happened to you was so... What's the word? So grotesque, so... Yeah. Such a stain on your life.
It was a stain on my life. I didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
No way. I read about rape. I knew about rape because it happened to me. I didn't know at the time, but it did happen to me. As I got bigger and older, I thought of the bastards. You know, and that's what made me feel. I didn't know what they'd done when I was 14, but if I was about 20 or 19, I reckon I would have shot them.
What would you say if you could go back to your 14-year-old self now? Would you encourage your 14-year-old self to speak out about what had happened? Or was it the right thing for you to do, to bottle it up and not speak?
Well, people used to bottle things up them days. There's no two ways about it. Even now today, you get a name come up that's been accused of doing something naughty to girls, and then all of a sudden, before you know where you are, you've got 20 of them, you know. They're bottled it in. If they've been raped... The amount of people that's been raped, and they won't talk about it. They won't say anything about it. But it's a long while afterwards that all of a sudden they do. Because they say, the bastard, he's not going to get away with it.
You hear things in the media like people are coming out the woodwork now. Like, how can they delay this so long? Like, why didn't they speak about it at the time?
Well, that's right, you know. And but I lived in an era where... things wasn't spoke about. And it was normal thing for the vicar to be friendly with his choir boys. Nothing was said about it.
What would you say to someone if it had happened to them? So if someone's listening to this, a young teenage boy or a girl, whoever, or someone who's later on in their life who's having memory problems and thinking about it all the time... Would you give any advice to those people?
Well, I'd say the best thing to do, I said, is speak up about it. Get it out of your system. Because when it goes inside, it just won't come out. And then all of a sudden it'll come out. Then I spoke to me, told me three sons that your daddy was raped when he was down a coal mine. Not very nice thing to tell them, but it's the truth.
I think leading by example, being a strong role model and being able to say things like that, being able to talk about traumatic events that had happened in your life are really vital, especially in parenting, especially with your sons and your daughters. Are you proud of yourself throughout your life? You sit here now, are you proud how you've conducted yourself?
Yeah. Yes, I am. I'm very proud.
Worked hard, provided for your family.
Yeah, yes. I think I've been a good dad, a good son to my mum, and Yeah, so I reckon I'm pretty proud of what I've done in my life. I've got no regrets. I'm as pleased as punch at 92. I can still dress myself, cook my food, come out under my own steam. And I can't say no more than that. That's about it, I think.
Stan, you are an absolute inspiration, and we will leave it there.